Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Enthusiasticast. I'm John, he's Mark. This is the webcast where we enthusiastically recommend an awesome book. We're going to break from format a little bit this week, and we're going to be enthusiastic not just about a book, but about its two sequels and its movie adaptation. And in another break from format, instead of one of us being enthusiastic and trying to engender enthusiasm in the other one, we've both actually read the source material, so we're both going to be enthusiastic this week. So to get right to it, what we're enthusiastic about is the Millennium Trilogy by Stieg Larsson. That's three books, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Girl That Played with Fire, and The Girl That Kicked the Hornet's Nest. And depending on where you are in the world, The Girl That Kicked the Hornet's Nest may not be published. It's coming to North America May 25th. However, the audiobook, for some reason, was released in November, so we both listened to that, which is how we've come to read or at least absorb the material. And we're going to just speak in broad terms, general terms about the books. There's going to be no plot spoilers. So hopefully coming out of this, if it all sounds interesting, you'll be able to go and have the same experience with the books that we had with the books. We've also seen the first of the three films that have been produced. They're Swedish films, Swedish language films. All three have been made and released in Sweden and a few other countries, but the first book is getting a subtitled release in North America. It's out in select theaters now, and on April 16th, it'll be getting a wide release in North America. So, Mark, you've seen the film, you've read the books. What did you think of one or all four?
Dude, these are amazing. So the problem is going to be able to getting to talk about this without spoiling the crap out of them, really.
We can do it.
And we might have to call spoilers at the end or do something, because I'm just kind of bursting with enthusiasm for this
stuff. Okay, if it feels like we're going to go there, we'll call spoilers and let listeners know to jump off.
Or I'll do my best.
Okay.
Because, right, it's about reproducing the experience, right? And so I'm there. I just am like, oh, man, because, like, we actually got preview tickets to go see kind of like a preview screening of the movie. We were talking about it then, and we was like, no, we can't talk about it. No, we can't talk about it. And then I was like, I have more to say than I can possibly say about this in, like, a convenient amount of time, right? Like, I think there's lots to kind of dig into here.
Well, there's 75 hours of audio, so.
So true. So,
a fun fact that I found out about these books was that in 2008, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was the second best-selling book in the world after The Kite Runner. So a lot of people have read these books, but let's assume that, you know, we're talking to somebody who's never read these books or even heard that much about them. What's the log line? What kind of book are they?
Right. Okay. So yes, these books are a phenomenon. We're late to the party. North America, we're a little early on the North American side,
internationally, we've shown up lately with a box of wine and, like, a bad shirt.
So the interesting part of the interesting story about Stieg Larsson in this trilogy is that Stieg Larsson died. He wrote all three. He sent them to a publisher after. So he wrote the first one, sent it in. It was rejected. He wrote two more. Finally got the first one published, died, and then the subsequent two were published posthumously.
Yes.
Right? So when they were translated into English and became kind of a phenomena in the publishing world, the talk was, like, how do you do promotion for a guy that's dead? Like, this is like a new book, but the guy's gone. And
Margaret Atwood's long pen does not reach from beyond the grave.
So you're just kind of like morbid inside publishing baseball was the story behind the story kind of thing, right? And so he was a journalist in Stockholm and was kind of working at a monthly magazine that did kind of left-leaning, provocative journalism.
Yeah,
that
called Expo.
Right. And of course, that's translated to Millennium Magazine in the trilogy. So basically, the story is that there's Mikael Blomkvist, who is a crusading Swedish journalist who's recently been disgraced. And there's Lisbeth Salander, who is a 24-year-old hacker with kind of antisocial tendencies. And the two of them hook up when Blomkvist is hired to research the disappearance 40 years before of kind of this scion of a rich industrial family. So this girl, 17 at the time, was murdered on kind of the family estate. Her body was never found, and the strong suspicion is that it was one of her family members. And this family estate happened to be on an island that no one could get on or off of at the time of her disappearance. So the trilogy, you know, kind of throughout the trilogy, Larsen is basically kind of exercising his fantasy to expose corruption in kind of business, patriarchy, government, and there's lots of kind of intrigue with the Fourth Estate. Readers kind of go along for the ride, and there's lots of like coffee and sex and hacking and more sex, kind of good and bad sex, and it all kind of culminates in like takedown journalism, right? Which is clearly, you know, an extension of Larsen's kind of internal world, right? So Yeah, I could talk about it some more. I could give away kind of
the ending,
I don't want to do that.
So don't do anything of that. There was a couple of things that I wanted to bounce off there. So just as you said, the plot engine of the first book is basically, you know, this Swedish odd couple working on this locked room mystery, but, you know, there's a backdrop of like, you know, sex and violence and, you know, family secrets. That's all we're going to say about that. It's great. You talked about him sort of, you know, putting forward his sort of fantasy of, you know, crusading journalism. And then also, you know, there's the real world facts of how the book came to be published. I think it's interesting that he wrote all three of these books before the first one was published. And at the time of his death, he was well into a fourth book and had outlines for a fifth and a sixth, and apparently planned these to go to 10. So what we should say, though, that the three books as they stand form a satisfying trilogy. Like, you're not going – you know, it doesn't end on a cliffhanger. You're not going to walk away from the third book going, oh, God, if only he'd lived, we would find out, you know, what happens. Definitely, you know, you could see how it could go on and there could be more. But it's absolutely satisfying as it stands. The other thing that I wanted to say is I think that it gets – a certain something from, I guess, you know, he was a working journalist, also apparently one of the biggest science fiction fans in Sweden, you know, ran several like fan organizations for years, published fanzines back in the 70s. Like, so he's, you know, he participated in fandoms as well as being a guy who's now generated his own fandoms. Like, if you go out on the web, there's like Lisbeth Salander, you know, fan pages and Stieg Larsson fan pages. So he has a fan's mentality, and he would write this book, you know, after work, just in his free time, solely pretty much for his own amusement, right? Like, when you get a rejection letter on your first one and continue to get rejection letters, he went and wrote another 1,500 pages with no promise that any of this would ever see the light of a binding. So I think he had to be doing it for himself. And so there's that element of he's serving his own fantasies. And just to make a really weird sort of comparison, it does map a little bit to Stephanie Meyer and the Twilight books, where she, I mean, one of the main criticisms of her is that she's writing basically authored fan fiction, that her books read like fan fiction, right? And they're very much her fantasies. She's not a great writer, and her fantasies get, you know, kind of left of mainstream. This is, you know, what if somebody was writing their fantasies, but their fantasies were actually really interesting and they could really, really write, and they had, you know, a fantastic perspective on the world that they were like applying to those fantasies.
So, dude, man, we need to dig out the Stephanie Meyer from the archive where we talked about Stephanie Meyer over and over again.
I don't want to be the Stephanie Meyer apologist, you know, on the web. I just thought that was, as I thought more and more about this guy writing these books solely for himself and some of the things that is in these books, like the character of Mikhail Bloomquist is, you know, kind of a Mary Sue character, right? It's the journalist who is an agent of change in the world, and is also just catnip for the ladies. And, you know, and then you've got Lisbeth Salander, who has been accused of being, you know, a male fantasy figure, you know, in numerous places. So there's definitely that element of fantasy and wish fulfillment in these books. And I think it adds to the appeal of the books. There's a certain energy, I think, that comes across when somebody is writing about things which wholly absorb them that readers respond to. And obviously readers are responding to it in the tens of millions.
So I didn't do a deep dive on the criticism or critical reaction from this book. But I have gotten a whiff of people that are a little uncomfortable with kind of like the graphic nature of some of the activity in the book, and so the Lisbeth Salander as male fantasy figure is interesting. Okay, so it's definitely written from a male perspective because he's a guy, right? Like. And she's kind of like,
yeah,
I guess borderline autistic, and those are, and not very empathetic. So those are not kind of naturally male kind of characteristics, right? But is that fair? Like, is this like, how do you feel about the Salander character in total? Like, is this one of the strongest female characters you've read, or do you think she's just there to push your buttons?
No, I don't think she's just there to push your buttons. I mean, the phrase strongest female, you know, is she one of the strongest female characters you've ever read or the strongest female character? No.
The reason I frame it that way is because you and I in the past have had conversations about strong role models in fiction and popular storytelling for your young kids, right? Now, obviously, you're not going to give a 7-year-old this book, but no. I was trying to frame the question in terms of in those terms.
How do I feel about this as a portrayal of a woman in fiction? I would love to hear. I've not talked to any women who've read this book, and when I've spoken about this book to women, I've been very circumspect because I mean the original title of the original English language. Translation of the original Swedish title is Men Who Hate Women or Men Who Hated Women. And the theme of, you know, dealing with issues of misogyny and, you know, violence against women and sort of institutional subjugation of women runs through all of the books. And in order to deal with those themes, you kind of, you know, if you're going to point up this kind of evil, you kind of have to show the evil in order to knock it down. And it's in the showing of the evil that it gets problematic in the sense that, I mean, I found it very difficult in parts to read or listen to. I listened to it on audiobook, but to get through either way. And I wonder how women would feel about that. I mean, whether it would be too much, and I suppose it would depend on the person, and whether it would even be a gender issue for them, or if it would just be, you know, here's somebody dealing with something absolutely awful. But I absolutely think that Salander is a fantastic character, and I think that a lot of the way he sets up Salander is not so much to make her a fantasy figure, although on that note, especially given his like science fiction background, the autistic goth super hacker, I mean, absolutely, that's a type.
Okay. So before we go there, that's kind of – see, the issue is kind of the crux of the criticism, I guess, is between, you know, like he's clearly acting out fantasy on one side, right? So like you mentioned the fact that the Bloomkiss character is like this kind of stud, right? That like beds women right, left, and center, and that's clearly an expression, a fantasy expression of his, right? So when he's expressing fantasy and when he's talking reality, it's kind of blurry in certain cases because he does speak to real world issues. And gets kind of pedantic in places, right?
Yeah, I mean,
and so when he's indulging himself and when he's being serious, you know, are clear on the two extremes, but Lisbeth falls in the middle.
Absolutely.
Because you can't tell in a lot of cases what his motivations are for sharing that information, sharing a lot of this information, right?
She seems incredibly well thought out to me. There seems to be a purpose to a lot of the things about her. They're not just there to be elements to fetishize. They could be construed that way, but they also seem to serve, you know, deeper secondary and tertiary purposes. So I absolutely think she's a fantastic character. And I don't know in terms of, you know, a role model or what have you, or in terms of a strong female character, I find it difficult to categorize her in those terms. I just, as a character in a book, she's fascinating. She's fascinating to read about. She's not like any character that I've, you know, the elements of her are things that I've seen before, but this synthesis of them and this presentation of them is completely original.
Right. And I'm with you. I don't know if you want to leap around or not, but like you're talking about the goth autistic actor, hacker being a type, I think that the film adaptation plays closer to the type, right? And so in the novels, she's given a ton more backstory than in the movie, obviously. But even in her representation, like they draw that character way quicker in film, just by kind of playing to some of the audience's preconceived notions about things, right?
And so that representation in the film kind of points out that it's there in the page, that there's a lot more there on the page, but that the surface elements, when you just see them like in a quick film character sketch, absolutely you're like, oh, I recognize that character.
Right. And you know, you're always going to get kind of disappointments in the film movie comparison game. And that was kind of one of my disappointments where I was just like, oh, but can I really begrudge that? Right. And so
I would say to the film's credit, there's a visual shift throughout the film away from what they originally present you with.
Yeah, true. Okay, so let's kind of tackle the movie at the and near the end. Okay. I'm sure we'll touch on it throughout. But the other question I wanted to ask you about was, if you were to adapt the movie, would you have cut down on the sex and violence, or would you have left it as is? Like, do you think it's overdoing it? Because it's made you uncomfortable, but is that
I think
an effect that's worthwhile, or do you think it's just gratuitous?
I think it's to a purpose in the context of the book. I think whether or not you feel it's gratuitous overall would largely depend on your opinions about sex and violence in literature, movies, entertainment in general, right? There are obviously people who are going to be offended by the sex and the violence. There's a lot of sex. There's a lot of violence. There is sexual violence. That's the subject matter of the book, largely. Largely. And, you know, by necessity, then the films. I thought I was very... not worried, but going into the film, I was really wondering how some of the material was going to be presented in a way that wasn't going to melt people's fucking eyes. Like, it just, you know, there was stuff in the book that I had a visceral reaction to, that, you know, in a way that I haven't reacted to, you know, that I've reacted to very few things that I've ever read. So, you know, it was absolutely a question going into the movie, how they were going to handle that. And I think that they did a good job. They pulled back a little bit in my memory of what's on the page, but they kept enough of what was essential about those scenes in there that it had the effect that I felt that it needed to have for the rest of the movie. And then, because I think they made all the movies back to back and they knew they were going to be doing the whole trilogy when they made the first one, you know, the effect that it needs to have for the whole series.
Right, of course. And one of the things that I thought of was, because I'm not normally a genre reader, and I definitely don't read like murder mysteries.
Right.
I just was kind of wondering how this rated versus kind of contemporary murder mysteries, right? Because like bad stuff happens in like Dennis Lehane novels and lesser known mystery and thriller novels right now.
Yeah.
But I'm just not up to speed on how that stuff is presented, right? Like,
yeah.
It's not like Agatha Christie's, you know, poisoning the character at the beginning of the novel with no blood anymore, right? Like, things have moved on,
right?
And it's kind of
interesting how that's one of the things that's going on in the book, right? Where it's contrasting a very sort of classic locked room mystery, you know, where it's like, well, how did the killer do it? Given that, you know, nobody could get on or off the island, and there was all these people around, and blah blah blah, and yet a lot of the events in the book are, you know, very graphic, gory, you know, deeply disturbing things that are much more from the modern school of crime and crime fiction. But yeah, no, I don't know how this stacks up against other stuff. I mean, for all I know, this is, you know, I'm not much for the sort of torture porn genre of films. And I don't read a lot of really hardcore crime books. I like crime and pulp fiction, but it's more of the you know, guys shooting each other variety than people torturing each other variety. So I really couldn't say where this ranks. Man, I hope it ranks high, because if shit out there is like a lot worse than this, then oh my god, I fear for the world.
Okay, so opinions about the film, right? Do we want to go there, or do we want to talk about the rest of the trilogy?
No, I think basically we're saying, you know, read this book. Once you read the book, either you're in or you're out for the rest of the trilogy. And okay, if you're like us, you're going to be all in.
So your reaction to the movie, having seen the Swedish adaptation, and from what I understand, the Hollywood adaptation is coming with David Fincher
attached,
doing the first film,
yeah,
which is going to be amazing. So,
I think it was a great adaptation in the way that Chris Columbus's Harry Potter, the first two Harry Potter books, were great adaptations. It's very much the book on film. They cut out some things just for length. I think the things that they cut out, I was fine to see go. I definitely think you lose something in translation because, I mean, one of the things that I said to you about the books is that they're almost – that I feel there's this idea that Lisbeth has, you know, is mildly autistic or falls somewhere on the autistic spectrum. And I feel like there was a certain amount of that in the writing of the books as well. He goes into epic levels of detail about almost everything. They're like a fractal image. The more you drill down on the image, the more there is to see. And the more you go down on that, the more there is to see. It just – it's an infinite loop. And obviously a lot of that gets sacrificed in the film version, but I feel that the things that they sacrificed, I could see why they did it, and I was okay with it. At the same time, because I had read the book, there wasn't the same tension watching the film that I think there would be for somebody who hasn't read the book, and there wasn't the same tension that I had while reading the book.
So this is turning into a longer answer than I thought.
Sorry.
So basically, when I left the theater with you, I thought you didn't like it.
No, not at all. I thought it was great for what it was, and I loved Noémie Rapace, who is the actress who plays Lisbeth Salander. I thought all the casting was great, but I thought she was particularly fantastic, despite my misadventures trying to find out how to pronounce her name. Because every interview that you go to with her is like, and so I met with Noémie Rapace in a coffee shop. Noémie is pronounced No-me, and then like fucking nothing on Rapace. Nothing. And I'm just like, because it's self-evident. I'm like, this name is not Smith. It's like, is it Rapace? Is it Rapace? And then you read that she's half Spanish, and you're like, it could be fucking Rapace. Like, and here I would be embarrassing myself on the podcast. Like,
I need to put myself on mute, I think.
Some ethnocentric hoser. It's like, Rapace.
But you looked it up. You looked it up. So we can take with some authority that you've got the right pronunciation.
God, I hope.
Okay. That. So you're in. So you're in. Thumbs up for the book. Thumbs up for the
movie. Thumbs up for the movie. Yeah. And more thumbs up for, I think, parts 2 and 3 of the film adaptation, because I absolutely think there's more room in those books for a filmmaker to make choices. And so I'm more excited to see, okay, what are you going to do with that?
Okay. I was really, really worried when I saw the trailer for this movie that it was going to be like small budge, you know, like shot in like 4 locations on video stock kind of thing.
Right.
So I was pleasantly surprised by the look of the film. And like, I'm not one to be intimidated by foreign language films either. So the fact that it looked good and, you know, and translated well, I thought was awesome. The kind of, you know, Blomkvist wasn't as good looking in the movie as I imagined him.
Right.
Right? But so there was like a couple things about casting, you know, like, I don't know, this all kind of nets out as a wash, right? Because I thought, you know, Blomkvist as the journalist was different than I thought. But then, you know, when I looked at the Berman character, the lawyer,
yeah,
he was way more menacing in the film.
Yeah.
So yeah, that just kind of like nets out, you know. And like I imagined the island that this place that the first novel takes place on to be a lot more Cape Codish, a lot smaller and a lot denser.
Right.
And of course, in the movie, they went to the actual place he was probably thinking of, and it turns out that it's,
well, apparently the location of the setting, this island, is the one fictional place in the book.
Yeah, well, there you go. So,
but you're right. In the book, it feels like all these people are living right on top of one another, and then in the film, it feels a lot more spread out.
Right, and that ties back to what you were saying about tension, right? So I thought that the casting was great, the acting was great, even the dialogue, I didn't mind, you know, as far as I could tell. But I thought the fault of the film came down to the direction, and he wasn't building enough tension into the scenes, right? And so there was a couple places where I was just like, okay, a different filmmaker would have made different choices here, and I could have imagined a more tense, like, in terms of just the way he revealed information, right?
Yeah.
And so...
And he kind of let the tension out of a few scenes when he really shouldn't have, I'm thinking of one scene in specific, but I'm not gonna spoil it. But just to say that, just I agree with your point about the tension, that he didn't build it as well as he could, and then once he had it, he didn't sustain it as well as he could.
Yeah. And so I'm like, I don't know what the budget for this thing was, but like in a couple cases, I was just like, man, like it would have been much more effective if he would have cut away, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, and gone to like a helicopter shot or something, right? Of like, of the two characters like walking off into the distance, or, you know. But instead, he stays with medium shots in a lot of cases and lets the characters talk, and that I think diffuses the tension in a lot of scenes where it's just like, wow, you can really tell that this was based on a literary property, right?
Right. Well, and that they obviously felt that they had a large obligation to fans of the book to be faithful.
Yeah. So, hey, you can't fault them there.
Nope.
But curious to know what someone who would who has little or no familiarity with the franchise being introduced by the film. So
I think it's interesting that on the Swedish poster for the film, it's the two of them. It's Lisbeth in the foreground and Mikhail in the background sitting on a chair. And then he's been, for the North American release, he's been completely photoshopped out. And it's just her front and center.
Well, dude, man, her tattoo in the movie is way better than I imagined it in the book, too.
One of the book covers shows a version of the tattoo, which is like this small dragon up on her like back left shoulder or whatever. And the tattoo in the movie is this phenomenal full back portrait. Oh, yeah, that was one of the things that I like, one of the touches that I liked the most. And again, that was one element where I thought, wow, they envisioned something really filmic for the movie, and good on them.
Yes, amazing. So if you were trying to recommend someone to be introduced to the franchise, right, and you're kind of biased because of course you've read all the books first and seen the movie second, where would you point them to? Would you say that the film is a good entry point, or would you say that go with the novels all the way?
I almost feel that I think go with the books. Go with the books because I think there's more there. It's a richer experience, and I also feel with some of the harsher material in it. I mean, I listened to it on audiobook and I was driving at the time. So when shit got rough, I wasn't really in a position to, fast forward or stop or what have you. And I just had to grit my teeth. And I kind of feel like that's the film experience for some people. Certainly some of the people sitting around us in the audience at the theater who obviously had not read the book. Whereas I feel if you're reading you're reading a book in your hands, you can maybe, skim through some of the stuff, and that might be to your benefit.
Yeah. That's a good point. Okay, so I think that's...
What about you? Do you agree with that?
Well, yeah. I don't think I can qualify it, though, right? Like, I just think... I think I'm just have the experience that I had, because that's the experience that I had, and it was great.
It was awesome.
Right? Because I was just like, oh my god, right? And not being a thriller reader, being captivated and taken in by the story and turning the pages, I'm just like, I want my enthusiasm to be as infectious as possible. And so, unlike you, I have passed this book on to several female friends.
And what has been the response?
Well, they haven't finished it yet. So I'll report in when that happens and I get a verdict. But some of these people are rabid readers and kind of like turn through books really quickly, right? And so their reading experience tends not to be as momentous,
right?
In some cases, because I will like read one book and rave about it, and they'll be like, yeah, I read it, it was good, moved on. Yeah. I read five books since they were all.
I can't imagine anybody having that reaction to this book.
Well, I'm preparing myself for it because, really? I can imagine.
This book just doesn't have a meh in it. Like,
well, no. People like, I can, oh yeah, that's good, I would recommend it. And then it's like, and like, don't you want to like hand this to your next best friend like right away? And they're like,
that's what I did.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay, so I think we're both thumbs up on the whole franchise, right?
Yep.
The experience with books 2 and 3, I think we should probably talk about, just because the main character in the first one is kind of Blomkvist, right? And Lisbeth is kind of a secondary character. And then they kind of switch places in the second, right?
Yes, it becomes more about her, but he doesn't go away. By right. Any stretch, it just there is a bit of a sea change between the first and the second book, and then again going into the third book. But I think the things that are exceptional about the first book are still present in 2 and 3. It's mainly the superficialities which sort of shift under your feet.
Right. So don't go out and read them out of order. Definitely definitely start with the first one.
Yep.
And I think I'm with you about picking them up in print before tackling the movie. But if you happen to see the movie without knowing anything about it, please, please reach out to us because we would love to hear what you think. Do you want to wrap that up at this point, I think?
Yep.
Okay, so hope you enjoyed the show. We've got a blog up at enthusiasticcast.com that you can kind of check in at for more information and links about kind of stuff that we talk about during episodes. We have also kind of made the promise to telegraph when we're going to publish episodes, and we're kind of on a weekly schedule now. And so look on the blog for news of when the next show is going to come down the pipe. If you want, you can subscribe to the RSS feed on the blog and have that updated for you automatically. We're going to eventually get into iTunes. We're not there yet. So check the blog for kind of news and updates. And then hopefully check back next week. So until then, I'm Mark.
I'm John.
Thanks for listening.
Cheers.